This is KJZZ, your member-supported news and information station. I'm Tiara Vian, and here are this week's stories you don't want to miss. For the week of December 18th, here are a few top stories. In the news, this week there were two stories on prison healthcare issues, and after airing, a judge called for further investigation. Here is the first one in that investigation.
Lucinda Jordan hadn't talked to her father, Walter Jordan, for several years. He was serving time in an Arizona prison, and they'd lost touch. Then one day in August, the phone rang.
He has a really strong voice, and usually he's pretty calm about things, but I could tell he was really upset.
Her father had called to tell her he had cancer.
I asked him how bad, and he said it was really bad, and I asked him what kind of cancer, and he told me it was skin cancer.
Days later, Walter Jordan would file a notice of impending death to the Arizona Department of Corrections. He alleged that his cancer treatment had been delayed and was causing memory loss and pain, and he predicted that he might not make it another month. Then, just weeks later, on September 7th, 2017, Walter Jordan died. Now, attorneys for the plaintiff class in the Parsons v. Ryan prison healthcare settlement are alleging a review of Walter Jordan's medical records shows a history of delayed and inadequate care. In his declaration submitted Monday in federal court, Dr. Todd Wilcox, a medical expert retained by the plaintiffs, called Walter Jordan's case, quote, unfortunate and horrific. In his review, Wilcox states a dermatologist used improper medical techniques to treat Walter Jordan's squamous cell carcinomas, including a 4-square-inch section of Jordan's scalp that was, quote, electrically fried with a process called electrodesiccation. Medical records provided by Lucinda Jordan show after months of seeing a dermatologist, her father was finally referred to an oncologist. After evaluating a large wound on Jordan's scalp, the provider wrote in all capital letters, quote, the wound is horrific. I cannot stress how important it is that we take some sort of immediate action. Corrine Kendrick, an attorney with the prison law office, had Wilcox review Jordan's records.
Mr. Jordan's care and what happened to him is sadly very emblematic of the deficiencies that we see in the medical care that's being delivered by ADC and Corizon.
In his review, Wilcox notes that Jordan experienced, quote, extreme pain throughout the last months of his life. The medical expert equated the treatment offered in Arizona prisons to, quote, therapeutic nihilism. The Tylenol with codeine prescribed by Corizon for Jordan was not of adequate strength, Wilcox writes, and not dosed frequently enough. Kendrick says her office has been flooded with letters from Arizona prisoners making similar claims of inadequate treatment for pain by ADC and Corizon Health.
It appears that oftentimes they are discontinuing the medication without the proper step down or tapering schedule. Some people have reported to us that it's just one day they're getting it and the next day they're off.
Steven Swartz experienced similar poor medical treatment while serving 10 years at the state prison in Buckeye. Recently released to a reentry center in Tucson, he says failures in the state prison healthcare system prompted him to file grievances, speak out, and become a named plaintiff in the Parsons v. Ryan settlement.
I experienced personally the lack of medical care, the inadequate medical care, the wrong medical care, so I wanted to bring about change.
Swartz says he watched his cellmates and countless friends suffer and die over the years. Despite a tough exterior, he tears up as he thinks about how the system treats those on the inside. Remember, he says, most of them are getting back out.
And they're going to be damaged, they're going to be hurt, and they're going to more than likely reoffend.
Lucinda Jordan says she hopes her father's bold letter predicting his horrific death will spur the courts and the Department of Corrections to hold Corizon Health accountable for the well-being of the inmates still behind bars.
Because, yeah, he did some bad things, he did, but in the end, he's trying to save other people's lives. So I feel like it was kind of his way to make up for what he'd done. And that's a proud moment. And believe me, I haven't had too many of those.
The Arizona Department of Corrections and Corizon Health have not responded to the allegations filed in federal court Monday afternoon. Jimmy Jenkins, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
And now a look at the holidays. Here's Christina Estes on KJZZ's The Show.
A new survey by Pew Research Center finds 9 in 10 American adults plan to celebrate Christmas. But the way in which they celebrate appears to be changing. Joining me to discuss the findings is Research Associate Elizabeth Shupek. Elizabeth, you found the role of religion in Christmas celebrations declining compared to just a few years ago. How so?
One of the things that we did find, it was a new question that we asked this year to find out how people felt the religious aspects of Christmas how much they were emphasized compared to in the past. And what we found is that a slim majority of Americans think that, in general, the religious aspects of Christmas are emphasized less now than they are in the past. But the most striking thing about this finding is that even though a majority say religion is emphasized less now, not as many people say that they are bothered by it. It's about a third say that this bothers them a lot or bothers them some.
What did you find in terms of those who celebrate it as a religious holiday versus a cultural holiday and combining both?
About 46% of Americans say that they celebrate Christmas as more of a religious holiday, and 9% celebrate it as both religious and cultural. About 55%, so about half there, and that about a third say that they celebrate it as more of a cultural holiday. That's in 2017, and in 2013, you had a slightly higher share saying that they celebrate it as more of a religious holiday. You had about half saying that that was kind of their sole way of celebrating it, and 7% saying that it was both religious and cultural, though the share that say only it's more of a cultural holiday, that has not changed much over the past 4 years.
Do you find generational differences when it comes to who celebrates it different ways?
Absolutely. And the generational story here is one of, I think, one of the very interesting findings, kind of a step down from these top-level findings, but a very interesting analysis, because we do see that among millennials, among this youngest generation, fully 44% say they celebrate Christmas as more of a cultural holiday. So more millennials are more likely to say that they celebrate it as a cultural holiday than to say they celebrate as a religious holiday.
You also found what you call a noticeable decline in the percentage of American adults who say they believe biblical elements of the Christmas story reflect actual historical events. So what are you talking about there, and what kind of a drop?
This is one of the other big findings that I thought was very interesting. And I don't want to overstate it, because we do still see that majorities of Americans believe in each of these four elements that we asked about, that Jesus was born to a virgin, that he was laid in a manger, that wise men were guided by a star and brought Jesus gifts, and that an angel of the Lord announced the birth of Jesus to shepherds. We do still see that majorities believe each of these, and that 57%, so a majority, believe all four of them reflect historical events. But that is also a decline. So it's an 8-point decline in the share who say they believe all four of these. It was a 65% in 2014. And so while a lot of people do still believe, these are shrinking majorities here. And it's very interesting that these declines, that 6, 7, 8-point declines that have happened over just the past 3 years.
Are the declines coming just because of millennials, or is it political, or what's going on?
A lot of people would think that they are concentrated solely among those who are religiously unaffiliated, those who identify as atheist, agnostic, or nothing in particular. And that does explain some of the decline. Those who identify as religiously unaffiliated are much less likely today than 3 years ago to say they believe in each of these things. There have been about 9, 10-point declines on each measure, sometimes more. But the decline is also among Christians as well. And you can see that it's smaller. It's about 5 or 6 points on each question, but they are still noticeable and they are still significant. So it's kind of across the board. I do think the one thing that I did find striking is this idea of how you prefer to be greeted during the holidays. And I think to me that was one of the most striking findings, is that there is always this question about, do you prefer Merry Christmas? Do you prefer Happy Holidays? Is this something that is really on people's radar? And to find fully half saying that it just doesn't matter, and the shift in temperament on that question, because we asked that in 2005 and again in 2012, and when we asked it then, people were pretty split on saying they preferred Merry Christmas. You had higher shares saying they preferred Merry Christmas. So I think it's interesting from a trend perspective to see how public opinion has changed on that, that about 43% and 42% said they preferred Merry Christmas as recently as 2012, and today you see fully half saying it really does not matter. This is not something that is, very, very important to people.
Well, I'm not really sure how to end this interview, whether to say Merry Christmas or Happy Holidays. So I don't want to put you on the spot, so I'll keep it super professional. I'll just say thank you very much for your time, Elizabeth Supek, Research Associate at Pew Research Center. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
This is the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast. Thanks for listening. From the Education Desk, just like candidate elections, getting the word out about a school bond or override on a ballot takes money. Donors can include everyone from community members to school employees. But campaign finance documents show some of the largest donations come from vendors who compete for the jobs the bond money will help to fund. In KJZZ's joint report with the Arizona Center for Investigative Reporting, Carrie Young and Evan Wylodge report.
The funds that support campaign activities behind school ballot initiatives are managed by political committees, and for the most part, where that money comes from is a matter of public record. Campaign finance records for the committees show architects, contractors, and various sub-vendors accounted for significant portions of the overall funding. From 2013 to 2016, bond and override committees in Maricopa County received at least half of their funding from architects, general contractors, and subcontractors. For some districts, these numbers are even higher. Take the Saddle Mountain Unified School District near Tonopah, for example. Their 2013 bond committee got more than 99% of their funding from those vendor categories. The district's 2014 override election was similar, coming in at about 96%.
Now, numbers tell only part of the story. To find out more, we started asking questions.
Hi, my name is Carrie Young. I'm a
I am working on a story and...
So do you think if I call back around 11:30, I might be able to catch
her? We spoke with Kimberly Moran, the treasurer of Continue the Quality, which campaigns for three West Valley school districts. Of the $122,000 her committee raised for elections in 2014, 2015, and 2016, $92,000 of that came from potential vendors. More than half of that came from three architects and three construction firms.
Yeah, it's no secret that it's the folks that are going to actually be making money potentially off of the contracting portion of this that contribute to the campaign.
Moran is quick to add that a $10,000 campaign contribution isn't going to buy you a contract, but...
I guess maybe if there was a new company that was up and coming, that would be definitely a way to start relationships in the district.
And it is this, what I think is a less than ideal situation, that in order to build a school, we have to reach out to the vendors who might be building the school in order to pass the bonds to pay those same vendors or different vendors.
Mitzi Epstein is a state legislator and former chair of Yes Public Ed, a committee that ran campaigns for the Kyrene School District's ballot initiatives. Epstein says she can see how quid pro quo could be inferred from this pattern, but stresses that the state-mandated procurement process, which in most cases involves a committee review and ratings-based selection process, would prevent that.
But when we asked a cross-section of architecture firms, contractors, and subcontractors that do a lot of the work in the K-12 sector here, they say their motives are simple: to support public education because the state isn't providing adequate funding.
It's important to me to help kids.
If we're not investing in our kids, we've got a big issue.
Our fellow architects are as, I believe, dedicated to really helping our future kids.
That was Barry Chase with Chase Building Team, Natalie Orne with Core Construction, and Pam Leffelman with DLR Group Architects. And when we asked these companies why they carried so much of the campaign finance burden for the school bond and override committees, they told us that helping schools get the funding they need is just the right thing to do. Again, Natalie Orne with Core Construction.
That's what we believe is right, is supporting our public school system.
For some districts, the support goes beyond campaign financing. Several leaders and employees of these potential vendors are also active participants on school foundations, which are separate nonprofits that raise money for a particular school. Orne, for example, is the president of the Queen Creek Schools Education Foundation. Architecture firm Orkut Winslow also has a tie to that foundation. Visby Karanja, a managing partner with the company, is the foundation's vice president.
I think in the overall scheme of things, at least for Orkut Winslow, it balances out. We don't just support districts who only have construction bonds going up. Our resources are limited, but we try to help out as many as we can.
Some campaign support we can't track as easily. In 2012 and 2013, a group called the Coalition for Education Excellence raised about $449,000 and donated it to a variety of bond and override committees. Because it's a 501c4, the group isn't required to disclose the source of their funds. That fact often earns 501c4s that spend money in elections the moniker dark money groups. But Kathy Elliott, the treasurer for the group, told us the money came from vendors who worked with the districts. During an on-the-record interview that was not recorded, she also said the group was established to keep secret the fact that it was architects, contractors, and subcontractors putting money towards helping the bond and override elections pass.
As we mentioned in yesterday's story, public K-12 districts award more repeat business contracts than any other public entities in the state. Dean Howard, who worked in public procurement for Goodyear and Phoenix and now works for a large electrical engineering firm, says he's observed the same patterns.
There are a lot of discussions about, well, there's only really, you know, two or three, maybe four general contractors that are getting all that work. To me, I hear that, I'm like, well, okay, what about the subcontractors? Well, that's kind of the same deal. Well, then maybe I just don't even want to mess with that.
But Laura Felton, the assistant superintendent for business operations at the Paradise Valley School District, says that pattern has nothing to do with favorites.
If you're in a tenuous situation where you have a live campus going, a very active community, you're going to be using the people you've had success with in the past.
Michelle Gales, the chief strategy officer at the Phoenix Union High School District, adds,
I know the seriousness with which the team at Phoenix Union takes the procurement process. And so really just focusing on the due diligence of it and making sure that everything that is a decision is based really on qualifications to do the job.
One of our final stops for this story was the School Facilities Board. Carrie Campbell, the SFB's Executive Director of Operations, says the agency has a unique view of this landscape because they review the contracts for the school building projects they fund and make sure all other school projects meet minimum quality standards.
We have found that school districts often pick the same vendors over and over and over again.
Campbell says some are better than others, though she wouldn't name specifics.
And some of those that they choose, we have the same problems with, every project. You know, they don't follow the documentation process like they should. They're, you know, not as communicative as they could be.
Campbell says her agency has considered supporting legislation that would add new oversight to the school's procurement process following bond and override elections. Right now, schools must follow state procurement laws, but there is no central oversight for the process. Reporting from Phoenix, I'm Evan Wyloge with the Arizona Center for Investigative Reporting.
And I'm Carrie Young, KJZZ News.
In science news, there are differing opinions on how to manage an American West icon. KJZZ's Tom Maxedon reports that people hold varied views on how to best protect wild horses.
When you watch the opening credits of one of TV's longest-running shows, Bonanza, it's hard to miss the other stars, the horses. Of course, there's the Lone Ranger and all those John Wayne films.
Get down off them horses. I don't favor looking up to the likes of you.
And cars.
Even though Mustang is a dream, its low price is a beautiful reality.
And pop music devoted to horses. They are certainly iconic creatures galloping through the creative ether of pop culture, but why do they conjure up such a sense of Americana?
You're talking about an animal that is stoic and graceful and quiet, unless it needs to not be, and then it can do that at a moment's notice. And to me, that's kind of America.
That's Adam Eggers, spokesman for the Bureau of Land Management Office in Arizona. By contrast to other Southwest or Western states, Arizona doesn't have a lot of wild horse herds. BLM's primary focus centers on habitat preservation, but horse control on BML lands does redound on his agency.
It's a challenging mission to complete, and it's not something that we can do with just one tool. You know, we need a golf bag full of multiple tools.
One of those tools is the Florence Wild Horse and Burro Training and Holding Facility. It's the proving ground for a forward-thinking rehabilitation program allowing inmates from the Florence Correctional Center to train wild horses caught on BLM lands.
You know, our horse populations are pretty small, and they're pretty stable. They tend to not increase like we have in other states. You know, Nevada, Wyoming, Utah, those are the states that really have a lot of horses.
That's John Hall. He's the Arizona Wild Horses and Burro lead for BLM and the facility manager in Florence for the Inmate Rehabilitation Program, which trains horses for sale to the general public.
It's mostly a vocational skill. It serves as a great rehab program. I mean, it's been recognized that having these prisoners work with these untouched animals is advantageous for both. It gives them a sense of being and accomplishment when they actually are able to get that animal fully trained and into the hands of the public.
Away from the Florence complex 4 days a week, Hall occupies a small office cubicle in a downtown Phoenix high-rise building far from where you would expect to find him.
I would still love to be in the field, and I do get to be in Florence at least one day a week. when I'm there, I try to be working the animals as much as I possibly can, right beside the prisoners, helping them prep or whatever needs to be done.
South Dakota rancher and wild horse expert Alan Day thinks one of the solutions to managing wild horses in the West is via public-private partnerships.
The government has done a lot of things to take regular government functions and put them into private management, and with some real good results. And so I have suggested that some conservation groups be entrusted to manage some of the wild horse areas, and I think would show private management can do.
To Day's point, there are smaller 501c3 charitable organizations and refuges trying to care for wild horses in Arizona, like Wild Horse Ranch Rescue in Gilbert.
This pretty mare with the blonde mane, she's a BLM Roundup. And then Stormy, the one in the middle, he's a stray from McNary. We have a res horse named Chip over there, and then a thoroughbred.
That's Kim Maher. She's founder of Charity at the Ranch that cares for and trains about 35 horses. None of the workers, including herself, makes a penny for their hard work. She says one of the reasons why wild horses are even an issue is because of cattle grazing on public lands.
Cattlemen are making a ton of money on beef. And these guys, if there are 15,000 horses on BLM lands and there are 6 million cattle, the cattlemen are claiming the horses are using up their resources. Well, math tells you that's not true. So the horses just don't, their value is not equal to slaughter of cows.
Maher prefers the horses be set free.
I just think the government should leave them alone. Why are they spending money to round them up and then care for them in, you know, holding pens?
There are no easy answers for how to best preserve wild horses and who should pay to do so. BLM and nonprofits have slim budgets. Private ranchers have to make a living. Until the greater public acts on the issue, the fate of wild horses remains uncertain. Tom Maxedon, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
Thanks for listening to KJZZ. This is the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast. From the Fronteras Desk. Since August, teams of negotiators representing business interests from the U.S., Mexico, and Canada have been meeting behind closed doors. They're working out details over the North American Free Trade Agreement. And even though their meetings are a tedious line-by-line review of a dense legal document, there are a lot of politics involved. From KJZZ's Mexico City Bureau, Jorge Valencia has this inside look at Mexico's negotiating strategy.
Ken Smith Ramos is Mexico's lead negotiator. He's a sharply dressed man with rectangular glasses and diplomas from two of the world's top international business schools, Georgetown and Johns Hopkins. He started his career as part of Mexico's original NAFTA negotiating team 25 years ago, and he's worked in international trade ever since.
Sí, no, muchísimas gracias, Dr. Vega.
In a rare lecture at the elite College of Mexico, he went straight to the point. Why does this deal matter? For example, there's food. Agricultural trade has grown five times over during NAFTA. The U.S. sends lots of agricultural exports to Mexico, think corn, think beef, and Mexico, in turn, sends produce to American tables all year round. Yes, avocados, but also zucchinis, also strawberries. Eventually, Smith Ramos gets to the more interesting part. What's the drama? Some of the pressure points were voiced by Donald Trump since he was a candidate. They include that overall, the U.S. buys more from Mexico than the other way around. Trump has repeatedly threatened to withdraw from the agreement. Smith Ramos says Mexico's political strategy is to lobby the more amicable parties in the U.S.
Basically, at the end of the day, it's a combination of having the U.S. private sector, U.S. civil society, and of course the U.S. Congress voice their opinion on the benefits of the NAFTA.
In other words, Mexico is borrowing a strategy coined by former U.S. House Speaker Tip O'Neill. All politics is local. Smith Ramos himself met with Governor Doug Ducey earlier this month, and members of Congress have gotten visits from Mexican diplomats or corporations with interests in Mexico, though not all members of Congress.
Hi there, this is David.
Arizona Republican David Schweikert sits on the U.S. House Ways and Means Committee. That's the first panel that will need to approve any deal. And he hasn't met with any Mexican officials.
I have a bit of an excuse for that. This year has been almost solely taken up by the rewrite on the tax code.
But as it turns out, congresspeople like Schweikert don't need much convincing.
Look, I have a personal fixation that math is math, and math should always trump folklore.
Schweikert says he knows 90,000 jobs in Arizona are directly dependent on trade with Mexico. He says he's aware that many Arizona businesses depend on Mexican imports and exports. He says some politicians wrongly attribute the decline in manufacturing jobs to trade.
I've also grown to believe that part of the negotiation has a little bit of a theatrical feel to it.
That's the territory of trade agreements. They've gotten more theatrical.
Wells Orr was an assistant U.S. trade representative during the original NAFTA talks.
My job was to interface with the leadership in the House and the Senate on a regular basis, keeping them apprised of what our negotiators were doing.
Orr says many Democrats didn't want Bill Clinton to sign the original agreement because they opposed provisions on labor and the environment. And Orr says that, yes, political pressure does make a difference, even political pressure from outside the U.S.
Only to an extent. I mean, the most important audience to U.S. legislators, of course, are U.S. businesses that are directly affected by the renegotiated agreement.
One of the negotiation's most controversial provisions is over what percentage of parts that go into a car get made in the U.S. Orr says that if NAFTA is indeed renewed, those sensitive deals will be made at the very end. The next round of talks is next month. Jorge Valencia, KJZZ News, Mexico City.
And finally, in business news, early Tempeans began milling flour at near what's now Mill Avenue and Rio Salado Parkway in 1874. Mariana Dale reports from KJZZ's East Valley Bureau a renovation and transformation of the historic mill is scheduled to start next year.
Tempe City Council last week approved zoning changes and a planned area development for the first phase of the Hayden Flour Mill project. Baum Revision co-founder David Baum says the renovation will preserve the site's history while making room for a restaurant, retail, and office space.
I want it to be memorable. I want people to want to take their picture in front of that building.
Hayden Flour Mill was vacated in the 1980s. Tempe Mayor Mark Mitchell says the development will be more than an economic benefit to the city.
This will enable our residents to enjoy this space for many years to come and generations. For example, having the development of the Hayden Flour Mill will also provide access to the trailhead at Hayden Butte.
The project is being developed according to Tempe's Historic Preservation Ordinance. Phase one is expected to take 15 months from the start of construction in March. Mariana Dale, KJZZ News, Tempe.
This has been the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast, made possible in part by the Vitalist Health Foundation, the IEEE Foundation, the Cancer Treatment Centers of America, ASU Research, Beach Fleischman, the Arizona Community Foundation, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Thank you for listening to KJZZ and for your generous support. I'm Tiara Vian, and this is KJZZ, your news and information station.